Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Aidan Delgado, a U.S. Army reservist recently returned from the Iraq War, who spoke to thousands of demonstrators in Washington, D.C. for protests during the inauguration of President Bush. A report on pro-choice activists present in Washington for the inauguration who are working to defend a woman's right to reproductive freedom. And economist John Miller, who takes a critical look at the Bush administration campaign to privatize Social Security. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In late September 2003, the U.S. Army launched an offensive against the Iraqi resistance. Soldiers raided a home in Sumara on the Tigris River and arrested Selva, a 55-year-old Iraqi woman. Her husband, a former high-ranking official in Saddam Hussein's Ministry of Commerce, was arrested 6 months earlier. The army also seized the family's $315,000 life savings. Selva was taken to the local police station for interrogation. In early October 2003, she was transferred to Abu Ghraib prison, where she was strip-searched and given an ID bracelet. 3 months later, Army Reservist Specialist Charles Grainer was convicted of abusing male Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib. According to the American Prospect magazine, 42 Iraqi women were held at Abu Ghraib, but most have now been released. A military spokesman, Barry Johnson, says two Iraqi women remain in detention. Many Iraqi women are arrested because they are wives, sisters, and girlfriends of suspected insurgents. Yet, human rights monitors point out that this practice violates the Geneva Conventions. None of the women prisoners have yet stepped forward to say they were raped or sexually assaulted at the prison, but military reports reveal that some women were sexually abused. In one case, a U.S. soldier forced an Iraqi woman prisoner to her knees, kissed her on the lips, and then removed her blouse. Images of such abuses were shown to members of Congress in May 2004. A federal whistleblower has accused the U.S. National Institutes of Health of ignoring an AIDS drug study in Uganda concerning nevirapine, a drug given to African women and babies to prevent HIV transmission. The whistleblower, Dr. Jonathan Fishbein, says hundreds of patients in Uganda could have been put at risk because of careless and negligent research practices. According to the Associated Press, Fishbein does not question the safety or effectiveness of nevirapine, sold in the U.S. under the name Viramune. The scientist cited problems with the study's data collection, record keeping, and quality control. Documents show that the NIH knew of the problem in the Uganda study in early 2002, but did not tell the White House before George Bush launched a $500 million campaign to promote nevirapine in AIDS-plagued Africa. Fishbein is now fighting an attempt by the NIH to fire him as one of the several government scientists to question the Uganda study, which was briefly halted after 15 months of trials. Women's advocates in Juarez, Mexico, remain skeptical about the recent convictions of 10 men charged with killing a dozen women. In early January, the men, who belonged to two criminal gangs, were found guilty of killing the women in all cases dating back to 1999 or earlier. Each sentence was 24 to 113 years in prison. According to Mexican authorities, 340 women have been killed since the early 1990s in Juarez, Mexico, a city of 1.3 million people across the border from El Paso, Texas. Many of the victims were young women who were sexually assaulted, their bodies then dumped in the desert. Esther Chavez, head of Casa Amigo, a rape crisis center in Juarez, criticized the police tactics in obtaining the convictions, which may have included torture. Other women activists say the recent convictions are just a political move by the new governor of the state of Chihuahua, which includes Juarez, to rebuild public confidence. In 2003, a special federal prosecutor requested that criminal charges be filed against a dozen former and current law enforcement officials for gross negligence in the investigations of the murdered women. Julia Caldera, whose 16-year-old daughter was murdered in 2000, still doubts the commitment of the authorities. She wondered, "How can we trust that these are the true culprits when the authorities have lied to us so many times?" This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon, For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
As George W. Bush took the oath of office for another 4 years in the White House, more than 10,000 protesters took to the streets of the nation's capital on Inauguration Day, January 20th. Mingling with the president's supporters, many who were clad in mink coats, demonstrators carried signs and voiced their opposition to a long list of Bush administration policies, including the war in Iraq, attacks on civil liberties, and the rolling back of environmental protections and reproductive rights. Early in the day, thousands of Bush opponents gathered for several rallies and marches in locations around Washington, with many later attempting to walk through security checkpoints to stand along the inaugural parade route on Pennsylvania Avenue. One group, International Answer, was successful in obtaining a permit to have their own protest bleachers along the route. Aiden Delgado is a U.S. Army reservist who recently returned from combat duty in the Iraq War. Delgado, who has been granted conscientious objector status, spoke to thousands of Bush opponents at Malcolm X Park, where hundreds of symbolic flag-draped coffins were on display before being carried off in a march toward the White House.
Good morning. My name is Aiden Delgado. I'm 23 years old, and I'm a veteran of the Second Iraq War. We're all here in the Capitol today to witness the inauguration of a president who has bitterly divided this nation. So many of us have so many grievances. Veterans, mothers, fathers, students, workers. But I'm not here today to talk about the past, nor do I want to talk about an election that's already passed. We should be here to talk about the future and what is to be done rather than what has been done. I'm no orator. I'm just a former soldier, now a student. But as a former soldier who served in combat for 1 year in Iraq, served in Nasiriyah and Abu Ghraib prison, I want to talk to you today about a few issues that are dear to me. For this grand inaugural celebration, private donors will spend some $40 million, in addition to $17 million that we will pay for the security of Washington, D.C. The money will come from wealthy supporters of President Bush, some of the largest names in business and industry, AT&T, Anheuser-Busch, Bank of America, ExxonMobil, Lockheed Martin, Pfizer, corporate giants, and wealthy single individuals. The very people who say they support the troops so much and wrap themselves in the flag of patriotism at every opportunity. Indeed, there will be military parades. There will be concerts for soldiers and all kinds of flag waving and speeches, thanking us soldiers for our sacrifice. I understand that one of the main themes of this year's celebration will be honoring service and saluting those who serve. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I serve. And let me tell you what all these great patriots could have done with their money. These few days of celebration will spend the equivalent of 5% of all the money that Congress has allocated for armored Humvees and trucks in the 2005 budget. With those $40 million, we could have up-armored over 690 Humvees. This is something dear to me because when I was a mechanic serving in the southern city of Nasiriyah, I had to cut and bolt pieces of steel from an Iraqi junkyard to the underside of my vehicle to try and protect us from shrapnel and roadside bombs. We did this not because we wanted to, but because there weren't enough armored Humvees, and we did what we could. Or, with those $40 million, we could purchase 26,667 sets of body armor with ballistic plates, the same body armor that friends, parents, and relatives purchased with their own money to send to their sons and daughters overseas, when families did the job that the government should have done. We could buy 50,000 armor plates for bulletproof vests, something I know well because when I came to Iraq, I had no ballistic plates because there weren't enough. Or, failing that, if they didn't want to spend the money to protect the troops, they could triple the VA budget for soldiers who've lost a limb in Iraq and Afghanistan. These are the silent veterans, the ones whose names will appear on no honor roll and no official government list, the more than 10,000 veterans who have been seriously wounded in Iraq. The 2005 Veterans Affairs budget allocates $20 million for prosthetics and related care. Ladies and gentlemen, with those $40 million, we could triple it. What about the 300,000 veterans who are homeless in America today on any given night? What about the veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan who've lost their homes and their jobs? One-fifth of all Iraq veterans treated at the VA were diagnosed with mental disorders. One-fifth. What about the 250,000 veterans living in America diagnosed with psychosis and post-traumatic stress? What about them? They could spend this money to help those who sacrificed everything to serve their country and the men who rule it. They could have done all this, but they didn't. The administration likes to remind us that this is a time of war and that all of us must make sacrifices. Yet I see no sacrifices in the glamour and opulence of the presidential celebration. I see no sacrifices among those who rule, only among those who bleed. Today, patriotism has become an empty buzzword, a convenient cover for everything that we don't want to think about. True patriotism isn't waving a flag and putting a yellow ribbon bumper sticker on your car that says support our troops. Patriotism isn't making empty speeches thanking the troops, while with the other hand, sending them off without armor into harm's way. Patriotism is not that. Patriotism is sacrifice. Sacrifice for others. Many have called President Bush a king or a tyrant, depending on your politics. But that's not so. In the words of Stephen Pressfield, I'll tell you what a king is. A king does not abide within his tent while his men die and bleed upon the field. A king does not dine while his men go hungry, nor sleep when they stand and watch upon the wall. A king does not command his men's loyalty through fear, nor purchase it with gold. He earns their love by the sweat of his own back and the pains he endures for their sake. That which comprises the harshest burden, a king lives first and sets down the last. A king does not require service of those he leads, but provides it to them. He serves them, not they him. That is a king. A king does not expend his substance to enslave men, but by his conduct and example, makes them free. Ladies and gentlemen, these words do not describe our president. Thank you.
That was Aidan Delgado, a U.S. Army reservist who recently returned from combat duty in the Iraq War. For more information on the local and national groups which organized anti-Bush events at the January 20th presidential inauguration, visit the website www.counter-inaugural.org. Among the many demonstrations organized on January 20th to protest the inauguration of George W. Bush was a rally held at Washington, D.C.'s DuPont Circle. The protest was organized by a coalition of women's groups with the theme of mourning the Bush administration's assault on freedom and equality. Speakers denounced the flawed 2004 U.S. presidential election, the war in Iraq, and attacks on reproductive rights. Protesters were reminded that likely Supreme Court vacancies during Mr. Bush's term could further threaten the High Court's January 22, 1973, Roe v. Wade court decision legalizing abortion. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus was at the rally and wove together a collage of speakers and songs which focused on the right to choose.
On this cold inauguration day, a group of young women in long skirts and black overcoats, calling themselves Ladies of Liberty, harmonized about the right to an abortion.
The right to choose is on the books. Hallelujah. The right wingers give us looks. Hallelujah. We won't go back to what we saw. Hallelujah. When women's choice
With Bush taking office for a second term, with both houses of Congress more firmly in Republican hands since the election, and with a vacancy looming on the Supreme Court due to the illness of Chief Justice William Rehnquist, pro-choice advocates are confronting a daunting challenge. Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women, described how the administration has tried to marginalize and hide dissent. She referred to the signing of the late-term abortion ban, a ban that has been declared unconstitutional by three different appeals courts and has not yet gone into effect.
Those of us who are willing to stand up for democracy are relegated to faraway places so that George Bush and his revelers will be protected from the distressing sight of any dissent. As we all know, when George Bush signed the first abortion ban in the history of the federal government, we were sent down the street and around the corner from the building where the signing was happening. We had to be out of sight of the limousine that brought him to the building, because wouldn't it be terrible if he had to pass behind the tinted glass anyone who disagreed with him? And when you insulate your leaders, you insulate the decisions that they're making. And it's up to us to stand up and let those leaders hear our voices. Let them know that we are standing up with people all over the world who are demanding democracy. Will you join with us to protect women's reproductive rights? Will you stand up against racism and homophobia and classism? Will you stand up to protect workers' rights, the right to organize, and the right to a living wage for the work that we do? Will you stand up with us to fight right-wing judicial appointments that will change? Change the nature of the federal judiciary, that would reshape the courts, that have to address every facet of our lives, from traffic court to family court to the United States Supreme Court? Will you join with us to give the senators some backbone to stand up to anti-women Supreme Court nominees?
I'm Mara Lynn, national coordinator of the anti-war group, Not In Our Name, condemned the war in Iraq, then spoke personally to the crowd.
I had an abortion when I was in my early 20s, and I cry tears of defiant joy and gratitude every time I meet an abortion provider or a reproductive health worker. As a young girl who didn't know what the world held for her, who didn't know who she was yet, to know that I had control over my own body, my ability to choose whether or not I would be a mother, at that point was something that helped me realize my role in helping to transform myself and humanity. But all of this, Bush and his crew want to erase. And the Democrats aren't helping much either, so it's really up to us. Trent Lott says, with Americans fighting and dying in the battle in Iraq and Afghanistan, Bush wanted a strong military emphasis in this inaugural. Well, we say, with millions dying around the world, millions more being pushed into poverty because of what this administration is doing, love being crushed, and women facing a future where they don't own their own bodies and control them, we want a strong and defiant emphasis on resistance in this inaugural.
Women in the world today, hallelujah, must insist they have a say, hallelujah, for George Bush seems to be itching, hallelujah, to keep them barefoot in the kitchen, hallelujah.
For Between the Lines, I'm Melinda Tuhus in Washington, D.C.
Just days after the DuPont Circle rally, tens of thousands of anti-abortion activists gathered in Washington to call for the overturning of the Roe v. Wade decision and received a supportive call from President Bush. For more information on defending a woman's right to choose, contact NARAL at 202-973-3000 or visit their website at www.naral.org. As President Bush began his second term in office, he made clear that among his top priorities will be the overhaul of the nation's Social Security retirement system. The Bush administration maintains that Social Security is headed for financial disaster unless Congress adopts a scheme that would partially privatize the popular program launched by Franklin Roosevelt during the Great Depression. But most economists agree that the administration's forecast of catastrophic failure for Social Security are deliberately misleading. If nothing is done to change the current system, Social Security, by varying estimates, will be solvent until 2042 or 2052. Even if nothing else was done to shore up the system and the surplus were to be exhausted, Social Security would still be able to pay retirees 70% of promised benefits. Critics of the Bush plan point out that privatizing the current system will force the government to borrow at least $2 trillion and place retirees' benefits into an uncertain stock market where brokerage fees will eat into any gains made from investments. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Miller, professor of economics at Wheaton College and a member of the Dollars and Cents Collective. Professor Miller takes a critical look at the Bush administration campaign to privatize Social Security and the experience of other nations that have undertaken similar conversions.
The only grave crisis Social Security is facing at this point is the possibility that the Bush administration will start tinkering with it and try and privatize much of the revenues that people today are going to rely on when they retire. Look, it is not the case that Social Security 75 years from now, 40 years from now, is going to be flat busted broke, as George Bush described it. There is no iceberg out there, as one of Karl Rove's underlings said Social Security was about to collide with. If you look at any reasonable set of projections about what economic growth will be over the next 75 years, it seems clear that Social Security will remain in balance. But even if you take the charges on their face value, you know, the Bush administration gets up and talks about a $10 trillion shortfall. That's based upon a figure that the Social Security Administration came up in this incredibly pessimistic projection about our economic future. But even they would only say we were facing a $3.7 trillion shortfall. And to make it yet even scarier sounding, the Bush administration projected the number not over a 75-year time span, which is incredible enough, but the usual practice, but over infinity.
If George W. Bush is successful in pushing the partial privatization of Social Security, what are the expenses and what are the problems that will be encountered by the average beneficiary of Social Security?
Here's some of the biggest problems. Social Security is a really tightly run system. Currently, Social Security pays out for its administrative costs 0.6, less than 1%, 0.6% of the benefits it pays out each year. Now, if you take the money and you divert these funds, you're going to incur much larger administrative costs. If you would take these funds and put them in what economists call an index fund, which is the kind of solution Wall Street is less excited about, where you basically take them and put them in a stock portfolio that reflects the entire market and you never get to move it around, the administrative costs go up to 5% from less than 1%. Now, if you sort of have that vision of an ownership society where, you know, people are going to be deciding to put their stocks here and there and sort of learning from that responsibility, the administrative costs go up to 15% of annual benefits, from less than 1 to 15%. So whatever you're going to get a rate of return, you're going to be taking 15 cents on every dollar and giving it over to Wall Street stockbrokers. Just to get to that point, they've got to find $2 trillion to make up for the 4% of your contribution to Social Security taxes, or of the 12.4 that you pay in. They want to divert 4% or a little under about a third of it in order to finance these private accounts. Well, they got to make up that money. That's at least $2 trillion. Now, what are they suggesting to do? Basically, they want to borrow it. That's going to have an upward effect on interest rates. We already have a huge trade deficit. The value of the dollar is plummeting. It's probably worth noting that one of the things that sealed the fate of the Argentine economy was they privatized Social Security right before their debt crisis. It's going to be a tremendous increase in our debt load. Nobody that's alive today, no group of people that are alive today, maybe there's somebody that's going to get real lucky, but no cohort alive today, whether it's infants, toddlers, 20-somethings, 30-somethings, baby boomers, whoever, will make more money than what Social Security has promised to give them. And if you have 6.5% return in the stock market, underlying that, you got to have fast enough growth so there's no crisis in the system.
Well, John Miller, just a quick last comment, if you would. How have other countries that have partially privatized their pension systems, how have they fared? Two nations come to mind, Great Britain and Chile, which are often cited.
Great Britain is the case that's the most analogous to the Bush proposal, because the Bush proposal is it's going to be optional. In Great Britain, they've done very poorly. You know, people that have put their money into these private accounts are not better off. Administrative costs are much higher. Right next to Chile and Bolivia, the administrative costs for the privatized Social Security system or retirement program in Bolivia, their administrative costs are as much as the administrative costs for the U.S. system. Chile's done a little better, but to the extent that they've done better, it's because they've not had, you know, individual investments. What you get is an index fund, and it's not voluntary. Everybody is funneled into the system. But that's not what's being proposed in the U.S., and if you're for an ownership society, somehow you're going to be able to have these are your personal accounts, do with it as you may. Administrative costs are going to skyrocket. The costs are going to be huge. It's just not going to work, and Great Britain shows you that explicitly.
That was John Miller, professor of economics at Wheaton College and a member of the Dollars and Cents Collective. Read more about Social Security in the pages of Dollars and Cents magazine or online at www.dollarsandcents.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hindu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. In closing, it is with great sadness that we report the untimely passing of our friend and colleague Richard Fraser on Monday, January 17, 2005. He was a valued contributor to Between the Lines, and we send our deepest condolences to Richard's family and friends. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.